everybody. Welcome to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley. I am super excited about this week's show because I'm talking about the first big movie of the summer, The Amazing Spider-Man 2, for the first time ever, with the amazing Hollywood Heath Holland.
Greetings, true believers.
Welcome, Heath Holland, to the show. It has been too long. I accept full responsibility for that, but I know everybody is super excited to have you on the show. You have all read Heath's column every week at ifthismovie.net. Heath Holland on... dot, dot, dot. Tonight, I believe Heath Holland is on PCP, correct?
Yes, and other things.
We are going to be talking about The Amazing Spider-Man 2, and we will talk briefly spoiler-free so that you can get our impressions of whether or not we liked it, and then we will move into spoilers so we can have a more detailed conversation. Remember, you can visit our website at fthismovie.net, and you can follow us on Twitter. We are at fthismovie. You should like us on Facebook. You can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Listen to us at DVD Verdict by visiting DVD Verdict Presents and clicking on the podcast tab. And thank you to Michael Staley and Melissa Hansen and everybody at DVD Verdict for hosting our show there. You can find us in the iTunes store by searching F This Movie. But remember, to hear all of our episodes, you have to go to fthismovie.net. That gets exhausting and annoying to do every week, so I apologize.
Ed for that. I could have been like, you know, like, doo-doo-doo.
Yeah, could you? Listen, Heath Holland, I'm very excited to have you on the show for the first time. And for a lot of our listeners, this will be the first time that they are hearing your voice on the show.
It's great to be here, Patrick. Well, let me tell you something. It's great to be here. I'm so happy to be talking to you about Spider-Man and other things.
I guess before we talk Spider-Man, Heath, have you seen anything good lately?
I have seen some good things lately. I've seen a lot of things lately, but a lot of stuff gets covered on this podcast. So I tried to pick about three that I thought we could actually get a little mileage out of.
I like it.
And none of them are particularly like hot and new right now, but you know, that's okay.
Yeah.
Number one, I watched High Noon for the first time. Have you seen High Noon?
I've seen High Noon a bunch, and there's so many classic movies that I haven't seen.
Good night. I'm going to go now.
No, and I say that not as a brag. I've watched it in multiple classes. There was one semester when I was in grad school where I think I saw it three times in the same week in three different classes. There are so many classic movies that I have never seen, but for whatever reason, High Noon is not one of the holes in my filmography.
Well, I am jealous because, like, yeah, I thought I'd seen it too because I think it's one of those things where it's just so influential that it has seeped into certain culture, like film culture and Western culture, and it's been copied so many times. I mean, there's things that happen in High Noon that are in, oh, Once Upon a Time in the West seems to be referencing High Noon. So I'd never seen it, so I sat down this week and I watched it and was blown away.
Yeah, it seems like it'd be kind of right up your alley.
Absolutely. Well, you've seen it so many times, so I don't even know where to go with that. But, like, it's – so maybe one of the most influential Westerns is that – okay, so when you see it three times in 1 week of classes.
Yeah.
What is the the setup for this? They're like, we're showing you this because it is what?
Well, for one class, it's sort of we're looking at the shot construction mostly. For another class, it was with an instructor who basically just put on like cinema's greatest hits twice a week and most of the class would leave. So there wasn't really a context. It was just like, this is an important movie that people like, so watch it. And then the third one, I think it was talking a lot about the movie as a metaphor for McCarthyism. I like it a lot. I feel like I don't need to see it again for a long time, but I like it a lot, especially for what I would call a square Western. Like, I tend to like weirder Westerns, which I know you are a fan of as well, more sort of the later period Sam Peckinpah or Italian stuff.
Them as well.
Like, yeah.
Anything with Kinski.
Right. But as far as like a square Western goes, I like it.
Yeah, no, it is a square Western, but you know, so it's what it is. It's 1952, right? I believe it is. And it predates so many of the spaghetti Western conventions that I love so much. And I'm like, well, this was like 12 years before the things really took off with Leone later, I'm seeing, you know, like you open up with a song instead of with a score, like a lush instrumental score.
Right.
Yeah, like that. So I'm just preaching to the choir now.
Did you walk around yesterday all day singing Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling?
I did, and the reference of Frank Miller, like Frank Miller's coming. And I'm like, the guy from The Dark Knight Returns?
Yeah.
The Daredevil is coming? Like, maybe we should be afraid.
The director of The Spirit?
That's right.
So High Noon is good. I haven't seen like a ton of Gary Cooper movies.
No, me either.
And he's just not a guy who just strikes me as somebody I want to see in a ton of movies, which I know is horrible to say because he's an icon. But, I mean, obviously he's good in that movie. I don't have any complaints about him. It's just there are certain actors who you see in one thing. You're like, oh, I have to see every movie starring that person. And Gary Cooper has never been one for me, but I dig him in High Noon.
He's pretty laid back in that movie, and he doesn't seem like he's a performer. So, I don't know. He just seems like he's being himself, which works for that movie. I like you, I haven't seen much of his other stuff, so I don't know how that translates to. You know, it'd be great to see him in a musical. I wonder how that would go.
As long as that musical is Rock of Ages. What else besides High Noon?
I caught up with Gangster Squad recently.
Interesting. One end of the spectrum to the other.
Yep, that's right. Opposite of High Noon. And it's a movie with Emma Stone, who was probably not great for the role that she was in that movie. But, you know, that movie took such a beating, and I stayed away from it because everybody was like, oh, you poke your eyes out when you get finished seeing it. And I actually, like, I'm not saying it's good. I'm not here to tell anybody that Gangster Squad is good, but I really enjoyed it.
Really?
Really did. But, you know, like, you know me, and I've got, like, that whole, like, I'll drive across the country to go see a particular neon sign or whatever.
Yeah,
so.
Right.
Fact that they've recreated early 50s Los Angeles, like night spots and even just like the end credits being like postcards of places in Los Angeles, and then like the soundtrack, it's just like an aesthetic thing. I'm just like, you know, I would so I've heard or read that so like the Untouchables and LA Confidential, they're like, well, you know, it's no Untouchables and it's no LA Confidential. And I'm like, no, it's not. But I'll probably put this on before I put on either one of those, because the cost of admission, the price of entry for me is so low. And it's just such a pulpy guilty pleasure. Guilty pleasure. You talked about that last week. There's no guilty pleasure, but it's just a cheap pleasure for me.
I understand the concept of like, this movie's not as good as these other ones, but I will definitely put it on before the other two, but I do not have that feeling about Gangster Squad. I really wanted to like Gangster Squad. I kind of liked the first round of trailers, and the cast obviously is really good. I just thought the movie was like dumb. Like, it looks good, like you said, the production design is good, and but I really thought it was just too dumb.
It is dumb.
Yeah, I just if I want that experience, I'll probably watch, you know, LA Confidential.
Yeah, did he say he'd watch Mobsters?
I would watch Mobsters before I would watch Gangster Squad. I absolutely would, because I kind of like Mobsters. Now, I'm pretty sure that's just because I saw Mobsters in 1990, and it's just residual affection because I could not actually defend Mobsters to another person. And had I seen Gangster Squad in 1990, perhaps I would like that too. But right now, Mobsters gets the edge.
Are you insinuating that I'm like an early prepubescent boy?
I'm not. I'm only speaking for myself.
I am an early prepubescent. That's accurate. Moving on, the last one that I watched, the last movie I watched the original Godzilla. Which,
oh, okay.
Did a great, you know, the Criterion Blu-ray has come out, and you did a great review of that over on DVDverdict.com.
Yeah, thank you. That was actually the first time I had seen it as well. So it was within the last 2 years that I ever saw it for the first time.
Yeah, so I didn't watch the Perry Mason cut, the Raymond Burr American version, but I'm trying to increase my Godzilla knowledge going into the this new one with Cranston. And because all I know is that, like, so Matthew Broderick went after him, you know, and it's very Japanese. There's a guy with an eye patch, which he looks like an anime character.
Were you struck at all? To me, it seems like such a sad movie. Like, it really seems like a movie that was made by a country in mourning.
Mm-hmm. It feels very, like World War II is just still hanging there, even though it was, what, eight years later?
Which I guess is not, you know, very long when you talk about the country being decimated.
I think you can't get over it in less than 8 years. You're just throwing a pity party. You've got to move on. No, I'm obviously being ridiculous. That's a joke. No, it feels very sad, and it feels very – the monster feels like it's, you know, it's symbolic of the devastation that these people had endured and are still enduring. And there's a scene where – I mean, I don't think it's a spoiler or anything, but there's a scene where a mom is holding her kids, and she's like, we're going to see Daddy. Daddy's going to be
–
It's bleak. It's so bleak.
And it's weird because, I mean, it inspired this, like, goofy series of, like, a guy in a rubber suit and there's big, fun monsters. And they're so – nowadays the whole, you know, series is totally associated with silliness and camp and sort of B-movie bad almost on purpose or whatever, which I know they weren't. But there's none of that in the original Godzilla.
Oh, it's so straightforward. No, it is. It's kind of a tough sit, and it's like 96 minutes long, but it feels so much longer. It's, and I'm like, not necessarily a bad thing, but it just feels so heavy and oppressive. But I'm so glad that I saw it, and like, yeah, I know it can only go down from there because I know where it goes, and there's like Mecha Godzilla. But I'm really glad to have seen it. I am going to keep going with it.
Yeah, that's awesome. Of those three, you will be watching probably Gangster Squad the soonest?
As soon as we finish, I'm going to go watch Gangster
Squad. I did not have as good of luck as you because you got to see some classics and also Gangster Squad, and I saw mostly Gangster Squads. I saw The Other Woman, which is a comedy, in air quotes, that is currently playing. And I went to the – I was supposed to work one night. I kind of ended up getting out of there early, and I raced over to the theater trying to catch Spider-Man. And it had started a half an hour ago, and the next one wasn't for another hour and a half unless I wanted to see it in 3D, and I didn't. So I just went to what was starting now, and that was The Other Woman with Cameron Diaz and Leslie Mann and the brilliant Kate Upton. And it is a garbage movie that has a few laughs in it. Leslie Mann really is trying to do something, and I know there are people who are not fans of her who find her shrill and unpleasant, and I don't think this movie would do anything to dissuade them, but I really feel like she tried to create a character and find things to say about a person in a specific situation in her life. But mostly the movie is just big, dumb, broad laughs where, like, they take revenge on a guy by making him poo, and then a dog also poos. And I had tweeted something about this, but I'm fascinated by the fact that it's this movie that's made for women. And the women in my audience – it was a full house of mostly kind of middle-aged women. The whole theater smelled like perfume and wine. They had clearly been out and now were going out for a night at the movies. And the movie played for them. I mean, there was like practically cheering. So
it's the next Magic Mike is what you're saying.
I mean, that was certainly the vibe because I remember when I saw Magic Mike, they were so sort of amped up that even the trailers were working. And that was the case before The Other Woman. Like, they showed the trailer for Sex Tape and the trailer for something, and they were just laughing at everything, having a great time. So they were excited to enjoy this movie, and I guess they did, and maybe I'm just not the audience. But so it's a movie that is clearly targeted towards women. It stars three actresses in the main roles, which is great. Hollywood needs more of that. However, at the same time, the movie, despite these things, still fails the Bechdel test, which is, you know, there has to be at least one scene of two women talking about something other than a man. And the movie never has that. They only talk about a man. They talk about the guy that they both were sleeping with and not realizing. And there are a few attempts at suggesting that it's a movie about the power of female friendship, But interestingly enough, I think there's like two sequences where they become friends, but they happen as montages to music. So we see them like sitting in a closet and laughing, but we don't actually hear what they talk about or how they learn about one another or get how they actually form a friendship. It just happens in the span of like a pop song. And the rest of the time, they're just talking about a man. And it's filled with kind of hacky shit, like they're spying on the husband at one point, and so they play the Mission Impossible theme, and they go to New York, and they play New York, New York, and they're, like, having a girls' night and plotting, and they play Girls Just Want to Have Fun. Like, this is shit that's happening in a movie for adults in 2014. And it's very clear that they made a rated R movie, but then decided, no, PG-13, we'll get in so many of those 13-year-old girls who want to watch the movie about being married and having your husband cheat on you. So they cut it to a PG-13, and so the editing is very, very awkward because they're cutting around all the dirty stuff and all the language, and so it feels sloppy in addition to being shitty.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is go see it. It's this year's Gangster Squad. So that was a garbage movie. I watched Odd Thomas on Netflix.
Oh, interesting.
It's not good. I mean, I would almost consider myself, maybe that's a stretch. I was going to say I would almost consider myself a Stephen Sommers apologist because I enjoy Deep Rising for what it is. I enjoy the first, his first Mummy movie. I kind of came around on his G.I. Joe. Van Helsing remains one of the worst blockbusters ever produced in Hollywood, but he seems to be trying to do something different, but it's garbage. And it's based on a Dean Koontz book, which I have not read. I don't think I've ever read any Dean Koontz, but I've also never seen a good movie based on a Dean Koontz book.
Right.
There may be one, but I don't know what it is. It felt like other movies that I've seen that were better, whether it's like Cemetery Man or The Frighteners or John Dies at the End, which just came out. It kind of has that vibe, but Stephen Sommers just has no knack for it. And Anton Yelchin does what he can with the main character, but I could not get past the fact that his name is not Thomas, and then he's described as being odd. Like, literally his name is Odd Thomas, and characters call him Oddie. And his girlfriend's name is Stormy, and I just couldn't see past some of the shit that bothered me to care enough about the movie being bad, which it is. Two more real quick. Last night, I watched Murder Party, which is the first film by Jeremy Saulnier. I hope I'm saying that right. And he made Blue Ruin, which I just reviewed over at fthismovie.net. And Blue Ruin's really cool, and everybody should see it. Murder Party was this little horror movie that he made a couple years ago with a lot of the same people. And I had no idea what to expect. It's about a kind of a sad sack traffic cop who takes place on Halloween, which is always cool. He finds an invitation to something called a murder party, and he goes. And I won't spoil what happens from there. But
is there a murder party?
There is a murder party. There is. It's really funny. It's really good. It really kind of took me by surprise, and it shouldn't have because I had seen Blue Ruin and it was great, and so I should have trusted this filmmaker, but I just had no idea what to expect, and the movie really took me by surprise. So if you're able to track down a copy of Murder Party, you should.
It's not streaming anywhere.
I don't think so. It was for a little while on Netflix, so maybe it will come back, but I found a used copy for like a dollar. And watched it that way. And then, to punish myself for enjoying Murder Party, I watched... I was with Mike Pomero, who writes for the site, and we had watched Murder Party, and we enjoyed it. So we decided to push our luck. And I had also, in that same shipment with Murder Party used, I got a four-movie Blu-ray. It's like four of the Hellraiser sequels.
Yeah, yeah.
How well-versed are you in the Hellraiser sequels?
Not very well.
Very well?
No, not very
well. Well, you're a lucky man. So I've seen 1 through 4, I think. 1, I think, is a legitimate classic. 2, I enjoy because it's crazy. 3 and 4, I don't have much use for. But, you know, Mike and I, every year during Scary Movie Month, we do a podcast on a horror franchise. And we've sort of burned through some of the big ones. And so now we're wondering, okay, well, what's going to be this year's? And we haven't decided yet, but we thought, well, one of these days we're going to have to get around to Hellraiser. And I'll be honest, as much as I like the first two movies, I'm not super excited about the prospect of watching, I think, all 9 Hellraiser movies, because it just, the universe doesn't really interest me. And to confirm that, we sort of randomly picked the one with the worst sounding plot synopsis, which is Hellraiser Hellworld from 2005, where a bunch of gamers go to a party. They play some game called Hellworld Online, only that never actually happens in the movie. Apparently it all took place before the movie starts. And they go to a party thrown by Lance Henriksen, and then it becomes a Hellraiser movie, sort of, not really. Henry Cavill is in it.
Oh.
Man of Steel, Superman. And it might be one of the worst horror movies I've ever seen. I could not have been more angry and restless and bored by the whole thing. The tagline, by the way, is "Evil Goes Online."
Clever.
It is so, and I can't explain why without getting into spoilers, but it is so not a Hellraiser movie. I could go on and on about all of the things that are wrong with this movie, but it is, it's one of the worst horror movies I've ever seen. And the fact that someday I'm going to have to sit through all of these films, really depresses me. So I can say with some certainty that we will not be getting to the Hellraiser franchise this year, but something could change between now and then.
Well, hey, there's always the Puppet Master franchise.
Oh, now you did that last year, right?
Yeah. And you talking about Hellraiser now, I'm like, well, I don't think I've seen any of them, honestly.
Not even the first two?
No. See, that was one of those things that, like, growing up, that was not allowed in the house. And now I just haven't gotten around to it. And now you talking about, well, there's 9 Hellraiser movies that I haven't seen.
But see, that's the thing.
Go ahead.
That's how I know that, like, this universe must not interest me, because, yeah, I haven't seen half of them. And, like, if I had any interest in seeing them, I would have by now, because that's who I am, especially with horror movies. Like, if I want to see something, I seek it out and I see it. I've seen terrible Halloween sequels multiple times. Like, the fact that I haven't really made much effort to see 4 or 5 direct-to-DVD Dimension Hellraiser sequels means that I may not ever, but I know sooner or later I'll get around to it. So you're totally going to do that this year, right? You're going to watch all of them?
I think I am. I think I have to now.
The first two, again, I think are really good, but I will be fascinated. If you handle Puppet Master, you should be okay with Hellraiser, I would think, because a couple months ago I skipped ahead to Axis Rising, which is, I think, part 10.
I don't even know. At some point, you just kind of forget which is which, and they all just become one big, the terrorizing piece of crap.
Yeah. Well, they cut a trailer, and the trailer actually makes it look not horrible. So I saw the trailer, possibly on, like, Full Moon Streaming, and thought, like, well, that doesn't look so bad. And I had read what you had written about it, and I thought, well, maybe I'll like it more than Heath did.
Write about it. I don't remember.
Just that it's garbage. Like a lot of their recent output, it's barely a movie.
Is that number 10?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, they stopped making movies, and they start. You talked about it. You know, like, they just – it's a garage.
Right.
You get a few people together, and you may write some dialogue the night before, but you probably just make it up on the spot. You're like, here's what you're going to say, and roll. And there's no purpose or plot or anything. They're not movies, but you see the old ones, like Puppet Master 1 through, I don't know, 4, maybe 5. There's genuinely something there. You see what they're trying to do. They're still not good, but you see what they're trying to do. So you get faith, or you have faith for the later chapters, which they totally just piss away. Oh, you followed us over here because we got you with those other ones, but you know, screw you. You know, you're going to buy this, and you're going to buy the action figure, and then you're going to buy the doll and the glow in the dark T-shirt, and then you. Then you do, too. Like, if a new Puppet Master movie comes out, I'm going to watch it. Because I've been in the work.
Right, but I don't know who the movies are for, because I feel like, you know, once you see this one, how can you possibly want to see the next one? And I'm totally with you. Like, I would end up seeing it, too. But if they don't make movies that are at least halfway good, how do they sustain it? I don't know. Like, the trailer made it look okay. I watched it. It's barely a movie. You were absolutely right. It is terrible. I don't even know how to describe it. And a lot of their movies these days are like that. But yeah, you go back and watch the original Puppet Master and like, hey, they made a movie, you know? Like, it's not for everyone, but it's a movie.
There's William Hickey.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, I guess Murder Party, of everything that I just talked about, the only one worth seeing is Murder Party.
Really quick, you were saying that the bad Halloween sequels that you've watched over and over. Do you have a favorite bad Halloween sequel? Not one that's a good one, but one of the bad ones that you actually like.
I don't actually like it, but I could probably watch The Curse of Michael Myers, which is 6, more easily than I could watch even like an H2O. I can't get on board with 5. I cannot stand Resurrection. Like, Hellraiser Hellworld is the Halloween Resurrection of the franchise, minus Busta Rhymes, who at least made it.
Like, I have this strange attraction to Halloween Resurrection, and I know it's awful, and Busta Rhymes is just a ridiculous person in that movie. But that's like, if it's on, I'm so watching it.
For as bad as Busta Rhymes is, he gives it a weird, perhaps ironic entertainment value, and there is nothing in Hellraiser Hellworld like to latch onto. It is just dull, dull, dull. That movie made me so mad.
That's really the worst crime a horror movie can commit, is to be dull.
Yeah, like, you're a horror movie. You only have to be, like, silly or scary or gross or any combination, but to be boring is inexcusable. Speaking of movies that made me mad, let's talk about The Amazing Spider-Man 2.
And on that.
So here's the deal, everyone. Like I said, we're going to try and talk spoiler-free for a couple minutes, give our overall impressions of the film in case you haven't seen it yet. And then if you want to continue listening, you can. Or if you want to come back after you see the movie, you should. I will say this. I'm going to do my best to be constructive and to try and really figure this thing out without just complaining. Having said that, if you are someone who really loved Amazing Spider-Man 2, at least as far as my side of the conversation, because I actually don't know what he thought about it yet, you may want to skip this podcast because you will just be disagreeing with so much of what I say.
I think they should stay tuned. I think we're going to have a good conversation.
I am excited about this, sir. So we kind of chose this to talk about not only to kick off the summer, but because when the original Amazing Spider-Man came out, and I don't think you were writing for the site yet, we had kind of a back and forth about it because I didn't really like it and you were a bigger fan, and we kind of realized you weren't crazy about the Sam Raimi Spider-Mans, and I am a big fan of the Sam Raimi Spider-Man, so we were kind of coming at it from different places in terms of what we wanted out of a Spider-Man movie, because we're both big fans of the character and big fans of the comic. So I thought it made, you know, good sense for you to come on and talk about Amazing Spider-Man 2. Has your opinion on the original Amazing Spider-Man remained the same? Are you still a big fan of it?
That's such a loaded question.
That's the easy question.
I know. It's so complicated. I like so much of what the movie tries to do in a post – we're talking about the first one. Yeah. I like what it tries to do in the post-Sam Raimi universe, because you have those movies, and I like that it tries to establish its own thing while I feel like that one and the new one as well work against expectations, because I, for both of these movies, one and two, I was literally dreading going to see them, because they just look, they're marketed so, both of them have been marketed so, I don't know, just like flashy and almost schizophrenically. And I'm just like, this looks like the worst thing in the world. It looks like there's no story. With the first Amazing Spider-Man, the performances between Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone really brought me in. I felt like they were real people in a way that Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst weren't necessarily to me. I did not feel like I could invest myself in Tobey Maguire and Kirsten Dunst like I could in Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone. And I think for me, that went a long way into bringing me into that universe. And also, I think that I really got caught up in the romance aspect of it, because I was just on board with it from a relationship point of view. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. But there are a lot of problems with that first movie. Villain problems and some pacing problems, and it definitely does not live up to the potential that I think that it has.
Okay.
And it's, we'll talk more about it when we get into spoilers for the second movie, because I feel like the second movie feeds from the first movie, and I feel like you kind of have to talk about both of them if we can.
Yeah, but, we can.
But I do still really like that first movie. I don't like it as much as I did, but I do still see an awful lot there that for me personally works really well.
Okay. And now how does the second one stack up?
I really like it.
For real?
I really like it.
I so did not see this coming.
I didn't either. I went to see it by myself because my wife was like, I'm not going to see that. And so I was like, okay, I'll go by myself in the middle of the day. So I went, and I, when it was over, I walked out, and I texted her. I was like, dude, this is, I really like this, and I think you'll like it too. So we went to go see it together.
You've seen it twice already?
I saw it twice.
Oh, my God. All right.
We're going to talk about it. It's okay.
No, this is great. This is actually really good, because then it's not just going to be, you know, an hour of two people complaining.
No, I think it's going to be really interesting. I think we're going to hash some stuff out and figure some things out. I think you're going to bring me over to your side a little bit. Hopefully, I'll bring you over to my side a little bit. But yes, I feel like it lives up to the potential of the first one and takes the ball way further down the field.
Oh, and wow. Okay.
How do you feel like it does not?
I feel like the first movie had a lot of problems, like you. I think they did some interesting things with the casting. Like you said, Andrew Garfield, I'll take him. And Emma Stone, and they're adorable together. Martin Sheen was great. I like Sally Field. A lot of the problems with the first movie I felt like had to do with the fact that they were, you know, rebooting Spider-Man already so soon. And so they didn't really find a story worth telling. and so I felt like with this movie, they could really just be their own thing. They had all this freedom now to go off in any direction that they wanted. And I feel like they, I won't say they learned all the wrong lessons. I just feel like they failed to do any of the things that they could have done in the second movie. And I don't, I guess we shouldn't even go much further without, yeah, spoilers. So where do you rank this, let's say, of the five Spider-Man movies? Where would you rank this? Is this your favorite?
It is.
Oh, my God. You
know, Patrick, you know that I'm not a content. Like, I don't do things to be ironic.
No, I know you don't. I know you absolutely mean it, which is awesome.
I sincerely and genuinely have gotten dude, I cried so many times in this movie.
I am fascinated by the conversation we're going to have. No, this is great. Again, I do not begrudge anyone liking the movie, and I know that you're not saying it just to be contrarian. I don't want to be the guy who piles on, because that is sort of very much in vogue right now on the internet. And I'm certainly disappointed that, you know, I was kind of happy when Captain America came out that, for the most part, people liked it. And it was like, oh, great, finally, a comic book movie that doesn't have to be this polarizing argument, you know, where it's the best or it's the worst, because I feel like the past few that we've had have been like that. And I feel a little bit like Amazing Spider-Man 2 has some of that, although I feel like it's more, I think more people are disliking it than liking it, just from the little bit that I've read. But
no, I think you're right. It's does not have a lot of love behind it.
No, and I've been trying to avoid reading too much about it until we had our discussion, because I didn't want to be too influenced. So I'm not trying to be that guy, but it bummed me out. Like, it bums me out. So we're going to get into spoilers now, which just means we're going to be talking about specifics. And obviously there's sort of one major thing that we might spoil. So if you don't want to hear any further details about Amazing Spider-Man 2, tune out and go see it, or don't. I don't know what to tell you. One of us really liked it and one of us didn't. Okay. Let me talk about a few of the things that I liked.
Please do.
Because I'm trying to figure out a way to frame the conversation in terms of what I haven't yet pinpointed my overall problem with the movie, except that to me it just feels sloppy and just kind of generally bad. And I wish I could point to the exact reasons. Without just having it be a list of, oh, and I didn't like this, and I didn't like this, and I didn't like this, because I feel like there's something more systemic about the movie's badness, and I haven't pinpointed it exactly what it is yet. But, okay. Once again, the performances of Andrew Garfield and Emma Stone are good. Sally Field, I feel like, brings it. She has maybe my favorite scene in the movie. Spider-Man, the design of the costume is great.
You're starting with the design of the costume. This is not going to go well.
I'm trying.
It's got blue and it's got the red.
No, I like that they fixed the eyes. The physicality of Spider-Man, when he's in the suit and he's being Spider-Man, as long as he's not doing he had something in this one almost as bad as, hey, I'm swinging here. Oh, don't call me late for dinner. I hated that.
That was bad.
It was. But for the most part, you know, I like when he's in the suit. I like when he talks to the little kid about the turbine that he made. I like the way that he moves. I like all the free-falling stuff. All that shit is cool. I dig it. And I like the scenes between Peter Parker and Gwen Stacy, just in terms of their kind of flirty chemistry, but it turns into then something that I don't like, which is to say that there's actually no real progression of a relationship. There's just this off again, on again thing. It doesn't build towards anything except what we know is coming, and we'll just drop the spoiler now so we don't have to keep hinting at it. This is the movie where they tell the death of Gwen Stacy, where she dies at the end. And you did not stay both times.
I left after the first 10 minutes both times.
You missed a great trailer for X-Men Days of Future Past. And one of the reasons this bummed me out too was because obviously this is a pivotal moment in the history of the character, and I feel like between them blowing the death of Gwen Stacy and Fox blowing the Dark Phoenix saga in X-Men The Last Stand, I'm just like, maybe they shouldn't tackle these huge, important comic storylines. Maybe they should stick to shit like The Winter Soldier, which is like a cool, maybe well-known story, but it's not like, this just changes everything, you know?
I want to hear how you think they blew the death of Gwen Stacy.
Listen, the scene itself is fine. Like, the way that they illustrate her dying is fine. But it doesn't happen inside of a movie that I give a shit about. Like, my feelings about Gwen Stacy mostly come about from the fact that I find Emma Stone to be a charming performer. But they don't create a character for her. They don't really create a relationship between her and Peter, except that they're cute and flirty and like one another, but there's no depth to their relationship. And the movie doesn't know what it wants to do from one scene to the next, to me. That it seems to be written in the moment, and it's like, ah, no, okay, he's gonna, they're back together because people complained about, at the end of Amazing Spider-Man, he promises Captain Stacy he's going to stay away from her and then immediately breaks his promise. So in this one, it almost seems like it's a reaction to that where he decides, no, they're back together, but then he decides, no, he is going to stay away from her. But then he comes and finds her again. He can't stay away. But then, no, she's going to move away, so they're not going to be together. But then, no, he's going to go with her. But then, she dies. And so the tragedy of her death can't even really be felt because it has no idea what to do with their relationship.
I see the Peter Parker and the Spider-Man in this movie as a completely directionless character at this point. It's still early in his evolution, and he doesn't – Harry says it on the elevator when he's talking to Gwen Stacy, and he says, that's right, he needs you to help him make his decisions or to help him make his choices. To help him make his choices clear is, I think, what he says. This is a Peter Parker who has no idea what he wants. He's wishy-washy and all over the place, and she is running the boat. And I think that that's what we're supposed to take away from it, is that he doesn't know what he wants. He just wants to be with her, and that's not enough. That's not enough for relationship. And the on again, off again is because he's waffling. And in the end, when she's taken away from him, he has to figure out what he finally wants. And it's through her death that he is finally able to say, in Aunt May, Sally Field says, where are you going? And he's like, I don't know. I don't think he ever did know. I think that he was completely lost and completely just kind of flying by the seat of his pants, no pun intended. And by the end of the movie, we've gone from we've had an arc now where he started out as just this high school kid. And by the end of it, with great power comes great responsibility. The people that you love are in danger and they could die. And are you going to do what you're going to do at the cost of the things that you love the most? Have you read The Death of Gwen Stacy recently?
No, not recently.
I read it I read it today.
Okay.
Just to compare. Gwen Stacy is nothing. Like, she is just this empty avatar or this early 70s image of what a woman is. In fact, during that whole scene, the death scene, she's unconscious. She's not – there's no words spoken. There's nothing. Jerry Conway, the guy who wrote that story, says in the foreword to the book that he hated her because she wasn't a character. She was he said she was pretty and she was what did he say? She was pretty and she was sweet, and that's not a character. And I feel like if the movie did anything successfully, it made Gwen Stacy more than a passive victim of the fate that befell her. And she was in charge. There was no, she said when she, you know, at the end of that scene, she's like, no one makes my choices for me. I make my choices. And she was an active participant in her fate. I'm sure it was still a painful, a horrible death, but it was her decision.
Yeah, which I'm okay with. I would argue that they still didn't figure out how to make her much of a character, because I feel like, again, she's mostly just pretty and sweet. But I recognize they also make her smart because she works at Oscorp. And to me, the whole, like, no one makes my choices for me is a screenwriter trying to let Spider-Man off the hook a little bit. But maybe I'm being too cynical about it.
Maybe so. That's valid.
Yeah, I also feel like the movie suffers from many of the same problems as last summer's Star Trek Into Darkness, which should come as no surprise, as it was once again written. Both movies are written by the brilliant duo of Alex Kurtzman and Roberta Orci, and both movies, to me, shift what they want to be from one scene to the next. They seem to kind of make it up as they go along. There are extraneous plot threads. There's inconsistent characterization. But you had said, you know, that Spider-Man kind of goes through an arc. And I'm remembering, because I rewatched the first movie the other day, and there's a really embarrassingly on-the-nose scene where he first goes to Oscorp and he's looking for a name tag. And the girl behind the desk is like, can I help you find yourself or something? Like, she phrases it in such a way that no human being would unless they wanted it to be this obvious metaphor. And so, yeah, obviously he's looking for himself. But like Star Trek Into Darkness, which basically is a sequel that just resets the characters back to they were in the first movie, I feel like Spider-Man is kind of doing that too. If the first Amazing Spider-Man is about him trying to go through that journey of I don't know who I am to I'm Spider-Man, this movie once again just finds him in I don't know mode. And I feel like that's a long time for a character to be spinning his wheels.
Yeah, I don't have a rebuttal for that.
That's okay.
It is a long time for, you know, I know they have a long-term plan for these movies. And
yeah, I think that's a huge part of the problem.
I think so too. Yeah. But see, I don't want to just like rail against that though, because it is the way that it is. And
right.
Me complaining about it and being like, I mean, and I do, I was doing it yesterday. I was like, you know, so Marvel's got 2028 planned out, but what if the movies aren't any good?
Right.
And what does it mean? So they're setting up a Sinister Six and they're setting up Felicia. I assume that's Felicia Hardy. You know, they're just planting all these seeds in these movies for, you know, here we can do this. There seems to be a really long-term plan, but.
But here's the problem. Like, I agree. It is what it is. I just want them to have better movies within that larger construct. If they want to plan 10 Spider-Man movies and have it all be part of a bigger picture, that's fine. The Felicia Hardy thing doesn't bother me any more than having Dylan Baker show up as Kirk Connors in the Raimi Spider-Mans, where it's like, if you know what it is, cool. If you don't, it's actually not going to it's not doing any damage to the movie, you know? And if down the road she becomes the Black Cat, great. And those seeds were planted, but it didn't fuck up the story that they were telling.
Yeah.
I don't think this movie has a story to tell. What is the story of this movie? There's a ton of plot, but what is the actual story of the movie?
Spider-Man gains love, loses love, moves forward in life. I think that's all that there is.
Okay. I know.
But these and comic book movies are, they're so, they just take the ball a little bit further down the field. And I thought this one, I mean, okay. So you don't feel like, you feel like Spider-Man at the end of Spider-Man 2 is the same Spider-Man at the end of Spider-Man 1 or Amazing Spider-Man 1.
Except that now he lost his girlfriend. Yeah. What I want to see happen, actually, is if they continue to make these movies, I want the two younger Stacy brothers to die in the next one. I want every Spider-Man movie now to end with a funeral of the Stacy family, and that the family just keeps getting smaller and smaller as they stand next to different graves. Because I realized, yeah, we're ending this movie exactly where we ended the last one, except it's Gwen in the grave instead of Captain Stacy.
Cousins of the Stacys are starting to get really nervous.
changing their names and shit. Like, what? No, I don't. I'm Jones.
That's right.
There's so much in the movie, which, again, if it were a better movie, I would not be complaining about. Like, I can deal with a movie that's overstuffed as long as I feel like all of it's working. But for a movie to be this busy and full of things, and for none of it to work and for none of it to be in the service of a bigger story. Like, I feel like if they want to pick one thing, I think there's a movie here where they get rid of, Electro. They get rid of all the stuff with the dad, which we need to come back to in just a second.
Yes.
They want to make a movie about just the sort of trio story of, Harry Osborn, Gwen Stacy, and Peter Parker. Like, had they focused on that dynamic, I think there might have been a movie there. I think there are some similarities between Peter and Harry that the movie obviously tries to call attention to. I think it would make that climax work more effectively because the way it is right now, the Green Goblin shows up literally out of nowhere. He wasn't a character 5 minutes ago. Now he's a person. Now he's the main villain in the movie. Now he's responsible for taking away the love of Peter's life just because that's the way it happened in the comics. It's like, oh, shit, we got to get to the death of Gwen Stacy. Have the Goblin show up. And she's dead. Cue credits. Had they just focused on that dynamic, I think there might have been a movie here. Because when you think about Electro, which we can spend a while on, so much of, I think, the worst stuff in the movie focuses on is Electro-based. And had they taken him completely out of the movie, nothing changes. It affects nothing in terms of the larger story being told. It is a distraction constantly. And that was what I found myself watching the movie. It was like I would get involved in maybe a scene for a few minutes, and then it would cut to one of the other storylines that it has to balance, and I would go, oh, shit, right, we're still dealing with this. And then I would start to get on board with that, and then it would cut back to Harry Osborn. Oh, shit, that's right, we got to now Peter's dead. Oh, okay, shit, now we got to deal with this. And I just felt like it was trying to do so many things and did none of them well.
See, I feel like it is the Spider-Maniest Spider-Man movie that they've made, in the sense that it's the most like the comic book. And so when Stan Lee created Spider-Man, the idea was that he's a hero who has real-world problems, and he's got to worry about getting the girl, and he's got to worry about paying his rent on time, and oh, Doc Ock just attacked the bank down the street, so he's got to go deal with that before he can do anything. And I feel like the movies capture that really well, and that it's more about Peter Parker than it is about Spider-Man, and all of the Spider-Man action, the Electro stuff, and even the tacked-on Goblin stuff at the end, it's a distraction from what he'd rather be doing, which is spending time with Gwen in these movies. And I think what Mark Webb has done with these is made relationship movies at the core. I don't think they're superhero movies at the core. I think they're relationship movies. And that's where he has put his focus. And everything else is just the ancillary events around what he'd rather be doing.
See, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I like that. I think that's what resonates with me so much, is because it starts from a human place, and the focus is not on the superhero aspect. It's more like, I always say, when Electro, the Times Square scene with Electro, it interrupts something that he'd rather be doing, which is having a conversation with the woman he's trying to get back with.
But okay,
it's so okay.
Rewatching the first Amazing Spider-Man the other day, I was really trying to cut it some slack and try and see, like, okay, what is this movie's reason for existence? And obviously it's, so Sony can keep the rights. But did Mark Webb try and do something different with it? Because I always feel like it's a movie without any personality. And there are flashes of him trying to take certainly a more contemporary pseudo-indie style approach.
Yeah,
to the character dynamics that you're talking about. And in theory, I can get on board with that. I don't love it. I don't love his execution, and I don't necessarily love it for Spider-Man. But there's an idea of something there that I could say, yeah, okay, I could see that movie. I don't think Amazing Spider-Man's it, but okay, sure. Because Sam Raimi is clearly much more enamored with, like, 60s era Spider-Man. His movies are very much a part of that. And I feel like when you're talking about the Spider-Man having real-world problems, I feel like that's what Raimi's movies are very much about. And to me, the Peter Parker in the Mark Webb movies, his only problem is, like, Gwen Stacy. Like, oh, I like her, but I shouldn't be with her, and I want to talk to her, but I'm just going to stalk her. He doesn't really have – and he wants to know about his dad. Like, those are his two big problems, whereas Raimi dealt more with work problems and family problems and getting to class on time and all of those kinds of things that – are what I love about Spider-Man, but it's not fair to compare the two movies. And one of the things I want to kind of set straight is, my objections to both Amazing Spider-Man movies, in particular this one, are not necessarily because it doesn't reflect the Spider-Man character that I know and love. In a lot of ways, I think they do. Like I said, when he's in the suit and being Spider-Man, it really feels like, oh, this is exactly what I want Spider-Man to be like on screen. I feel like sometimes in the conversations about comic book movies, it gets a little muddled where people are talking too much. This happened a lot with Man of Steel, where the complaints about Man of Steel were, that's not my Superman. And that's fine if that's your objection to the movie. And when Amazing Spider-Man came out, it was like, hey, they made Peter Parker sort of an emo asshole instead of like a shy geek. And that's fine. Again, if that's not who you want Peter Parker to be, you're going to have a problem with that. I certainly prefer shy geek Peter Parker, but you got to get on board with the choices that they make and try and accept a movie for what it is. My objections to the movies are not that they're bad Spider-Man movies, even if I think they are. My true objections, I think, are that they are bad movies. And same with Man of Steel, that my objections are that I think it's a failure of theme and storytelling, not of faithfulness to the character. Does that make sense?
It does make sense, and it's so interesting to me because, you know, I have the same problems that you have with Man of Steel, and I have the same problems with Star Trek Into Darkness, and then I feel like, you know, hey, you're missing the point of what's going on here, but I don't have it for this. It's this huge blind spot.
Maybe I'm just hating on something that is unfair. Let's talk about Electro.
Okay.
Because to me that's symptomatic, again, of one of the big problems with the movie, which is that it doesn't know what it wants to be. I used to make excuses for Spider-Man 3 because, and I recognize it is a flawed, bad movie. But I always felt like, no, but every Spider-Man movie is about how it's hard to be Spider-Man. And that's what Spider-Man 3 is about. And I tried to rewatch it the other night for a piece that I was going to write, and I didn't get very far because I'm like, no, this movie's got more problems than maybe I can tackle. So I understand that in Amazing Spider-Man 2, some of the Electro stuff is very much like, okay, yeah, it's hard to be Spider-Man, and he wants to be talking to his girlfriend, but there's this, you know, supervillain who's fucking up Times Square and whatever. But I just feel like if you're going to have a major villain, he's basically the villain of the movie, even though Green Goblin shows up for no reason. He should somehow tie into the larger story being told or the theme of the film. And he does neither. I mean, his big thing to an embarrassing degree is that he wants to be seen. He just wants to be seen. And he even says it over and over when he finally ends up on those screens in Times Square. He says, they can see me. I mean, it really is like some junior high level writing. But what does that have to do with the story that they're telling in Spider-Man at all?
Well, the best I can give you is that I feel like I don't know how well it works, and I don't know how much of it ties together. But there seems to be a theme of, you are next to me, you interact with me, I contribute to your society, I contribute to whatever, but you don't care about me and I'm invisible to you. So the thing with that, they just hammer Electro, you know, that thing like just in your face all the time with, you need me, you need me. But then at the same time, I thought it was done a little bit better with Harry, because he needed Peter's help or Spider-Man's help. And he felt, I mean, he wanted love and attention from his dad. I feel like everyone in this movie wanted something from someone that they weren't getting. And I feel like there's a statement there. I'm not quite sure what it is, but there seems maybe, and maybe I'm reaching here, but I feel like maybe there's a statement about the reflection of the society that we live in, where everything is 140 characters or less, and you're next to all these people, but you're interacting with none of them. And when someone needs you and needs you to give of yourself or give of your time, no one seems to be willing to do that. Maybe that's where they're going with it. I don't know.
I admire this is a true statement. This is not me being a sarcastic asshole. I really do admire your ability to, like, look into this movie and pull things out of it that I'm not even positive are there, but that, you know, like, you really are trying to see the good in it, and to me, giving it more credit than maybe it warrants, but I think that's awesome. I just fucking Electro.
you mentioned the Times Square scene and how he's just like, all the people are looking at him and everything, but when he starts that scene, he's not a villain.
Right.
He's asking for help. He's coming to, there are hundreds of people in that area, and he's asking for help.
Right.
And no one is going to help him. And he's like, they're going to shoot me. And then he gets angry. So I don't know. That's the end of the thought that I have.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't, unfortunately, it doesn't mean anything, because it's not that they attack him because they don't like him. I mean, they are afraid of him, and rightfully so. And I didn't mind that he was afraid. I thought the conception and execution of that character was so terrible, and I'm obviously not the first person to reference the fact that it's basically the exact same as the Riddler in Batman Forever, which is like he's this nerdy scientist who admires a superhero and then gets a chip on his shoulder when he feels like he's been forgotten. I mean, the fact that like his big beef is Spider-Man couldn't remember his name when Spider-Man does remember who he is. He's like, oh yeah, the blueprints guy. Yeah. You're my guy on the street. Like he remembers everything about him except that his name is Max. And the fucking guy goes full on super villain just because of that. The way that you had said, you know, everybody in the movie wants something, and that's certainly true. And that obviously that's necessary for the most basic drama. Each character has to want something. And one of my problems with Amazing Spider-Man 2 is that each character only wants one thing and is only able to talk about the one thing that they want. And so every scene with Electro, when he's just Max, he just talks about the one thing that he wants, which is to be remembered, not to be ignored, to be appreciated, for someone to remember his name. Every line of dialogue he has is something to that effect. And then he gets like the full-on Halle Berry Catwoman treatment where he falls into a pit of electric eels and becomes Dr. Manhattan. And then he speaks in one-liners and plays the itsy bitsy spider. And this is not my line. Vince Mancini at Film Drunk, I think, kept making jokes about Electro being able to harness the power of dubstep because every time he's on screen, it's just bow. I just felt like, you know, Amazing Spider-Man had a villain problem. The Lizard was a bad villain who had a plan that didn't make much sense, that he wanted to turn everyone into lizards. But before that, he was a scientist trying to heal himself. And that, you know, Electro in Amazing Spider-Man 2 really puts Kurt Connors in the first movie into focus because you're like, oh no, turns out that was actually way better than what they do here, which is just this weird series of coincidences and conveniences and a, you know, by the time he does become Electro, then what does he want? Revenge on Spider-Man for not remembering his name? That's literally his motivation?
Yeah. Well, I think, yeah. But he's also crazy. Don't discount crazy. And did you like how the voices are going the whole time he's on screen? But even before he's Electro, whenever Jamie Foxx is on screen, there's like the voices somewhere. It's like, they laughed at me.
No, I did not like that at all.
Did not like that at all.
Not at all.
I thought it was an interesting, and I'll say interesting, because I think I do like it, but I thought it was an interesting experiment with conveying its insanity in a way that you can only do on film.
He said, "It's your birthday. It's my birthday. Time to light the candles."
Light the candle. That's bad.
But everything about him is bad. And if they take it out, the movie doesn't change. That's a lot of screen time and a lot of CGI busyness for a character that does not matter in the story that is being told. And that is a huge problem to me.
So do you feel like, because this is the Sony problem, is you've used your top tier villains in three movies that we just saw. Really, it wasn't that long ago, and everybody likes those movies. Where do you go? You know, you have all these other. I mean, Spider-Man has
great rogues. But they're already doing Green Goblin again, and they're teasing Dr. Octopus. So it doesn't seem like.
Do you think that's Green Goblin?
Yeah.
You know, here's what I'd like to see, because I feel like they can still do this. I would like to see Chris Cooper as Green Goblin, that he's not dead, and that he's somewhere. And that he will be the Green Goblin, because I'd much rather see him as Green Goblin than Harry as Green Goblin, which they didn't earn the Harry thing. They just threw it in at the end. But if they're teasing anything with Chris Cooper, I mean, they hired him. And if first of all, you're talking about Richard, like the Spider-Man dad thing. I don't think we've seen the end of that either. The plane didn't crash, and if I know comic books and comic book movies, he's going to come back at some point. I would love Chris Cooper, Green Goblin, maybe next movie, maybe the movie after that.
Sure. In theory, I would like that, but I don't have any faith in these filmmakers to pull it off. I just feel like the fact that they introduced Harry in this movie and then say, yeah, we're best buds, like when no mention of Harry had been made prior to this, again, you have to appreciate, to me, for a series of movies that is planning, you know, six different installments and Sinister Six spinoffs and Venom spinoffs, like, you go back to the Raimi movies, and it's not, I recognize that it's not fair to compare the two, but I'm saying one does it right and this movie doesn't. Like, the Raimi movies had the patience to set them up as friends, then in the second movie they turn against one another, then in the third movie he becomes the Green Goblin. Like, that's a progression. This movie tried to do it all in the same movie. And what did Harry Osborn want in this movie? What's the thing that he wants from Spider-Man?
He wanted his blood.
What kind of blood? Magic blood. Guess who else has magic blood?
Who?
Khan in fucking Star Trek Into Darkness. This is the fucking...
Mind blown.
This is the second movie that these two shitheads have written that hinges on magic fucking blood. They are the biggest shithead screenwriters in Hollywood, and how they continue to get work blows. I can't even wrap my head around it, that once again they're going back to the magic blood well.
We're not splitting up, so
we can come back to Harry, because I was not a fan of Dane DeHaan's performance. But let's talk about the dad, because you just brought up Richard Parker. I felt like, and you're probably right, like, we didn't see the plane crash, and when you don't, and Norman Osborn could come back, because usually when you don't see a character die on screen, it means that they can come back, although in the Marvel universe, you know, they come back when you do see them die on screen, so even in the, even in the movie universe. I felt like this movie tried to end that question of, like, the dad thing. I spent way too much time on the dad stuff. It opens with a flashback to the dad. The answers that it provides are stupid, and the fact that it needs to tie this in to who Spider-Man is or how he became Spider-Man, it flies in the face of everything that I know and love about the character. It's responsible for some really terrible scenes, but by the end, it seems like we have our answers and Peter is ready to move on. And I felt like maybe that was the filmmaker saying, like, yeah, we know people don't like this. Maybe it was a misconception to try and tell the untold story of Spider-Man, and they kind of closed the book on it. But you don't have that impression?
I think that if that's what works out for now, that's what they'll do. But if they ever need an ace in the hole, they're like, well, Richard Parker is the new Mysterio or something. Like, they'll just pull him out because he's there and they didn't kill him off. I think the storyline is closed, but by them not showing, I mean, we have no body, and without a body, they will always, they'll always bring him back, or it seems like they will. But see, I don't care about that storyline. This is how deep I am into these movies, is that I don't care about the Richard Parker thing, but Peter cares about it. And so I kind of want it to work out so that Peter Parker has some closure, because he's the person that I'm watching in this movie that I'm so, like, so caught up with, like, just his life, and just like, well, he needs to know. He's like telling Sally Field, like, I need to know. And I'm like, he needs to know.
Now he does know, because he found the magic subway tokens, and then the magic train station, and then the magic video that told him about his magic blood.
Platform 9 3/4.
Okay, yeah. See, originally I feel like that was their way in. That was their way of justifying, like, no, we know we're already rebooting Spider-Man, but we're telling a different version where Peter is fated to be Spider-Man because his bloodline is injected into the radioactive spider that bites him, which again flies in the face of everything that's great about the character, which is he's this ordinary guy who, you know, is in a freak accident or whatever, and then becomes Spider-Man. And then this movie almost doubles down. Like, they could have backed off of it because they cut so much out of it, so much of it out of the first movie. You know, there's all this extra stuff that I think Devin Faraci once wrote a long piece about all the stuff that got gutted out of that first movie. And most of it, I think, had to do with that untold story bullshit. And I feel like they could have backed down from it even more, but instead they doubled down. And it's like, they spend a lot of time in this movie on the Richard Parker untold story stuff. And again, none of it matters, because to me, again, not fair to compare, but I am going to once again invoke the Raimi trilogy, where Tobey Maguire at one point, I think even at the end of the first movie, says, "Who am I? I'm Spider-Man," and that's how the movie ends. He knows who he is, right? Doesn't make it less difficult to be Spider-Man. Doesn't mean that he doesn't struggle with the duality of trying to be Peter Parker day to day and be Spider-Man. But he knows that he is Spider-Man. And this movie, it's like, I'm Spider-Man, but I still have to know about my dad. Where do I come from? There's a great scene with Sally Field and it was even before that.
Okay.
He has a scene with Sally Field where this is how badly they are trying to shoehorn in all this bullshit about the dad, where it's graduation and she says, you know, I wish Ben were here. And yes, that is the story that they are telling. Uncle Ben was this huge presence in Peter's life and he's gone and he mourns Uncle Ben because he's responsible for Ben's death and Ben's death helped create Spider-Man. Aunt May misses Ben. So she says, I miss Ben. And he says, yeah. And it's like, yeah, they have this moment. And then he goes, and my folks. Like, remember, guys, we're also telling the story about the parents. And then later they have what is probably my favorite scene in the movie where Sally Field gives that speech about like, no, you're my boy. I'm the one who raised you. And she nails that speech. I thought it was really, really great. And he's like, you're right. I am your boy. And I felt like, okay, good. That's the end of that. And then he goes, but I still need to know. Like, he's fucking incapable of learning and, like, just dummy up and let it go. It infuriated me the way that this movie kept having to come back to the dad stuff, which ultimately amounted to what? In terms of the story being told. I mean, he finds out, and then what?
I guess closure.
Right.
Which is it, you know.
But what does it answer? How does it advance the story at all?
I don't know that it advances the story, but if you're looking at it from an emotional character point of view, maybe it makes him a more whole person. I know. I get it.
I just feel like they spend all this time to, again, get back to the same place that they started. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean.
And a better closure would have been at the end of that Aunt May speech where she says, no, this guy left and whatever. And I'm your parent, you know? And he's like, yeah, that's an emotional closure. This goes back to, I've always argued this about Spider-Man 3, where Harry has to forgive Peter for killing his dad and for them to team up at the end, which is a bad scene. It's all bad. But the way that it goes about is so clumsy because all of a sudden the magic butler appears and was like, no, I was there that night. I saw what happened. And he proceeds to tell Harry everything. And like, A, you're retconning your story. No, this guy wasn't there. B, it's a crazy, bad, distracting performance from Bill Paxton's dad, it turns out. And C, a more effective way to do that is just to have Harry believe Peter's story and say, okay, Peter, I put my trust in you. It was an accident. You didn't mean for that to happen. I forgive you. Without having to be told, no, he was telling you the truth. Like, that's good emotional storytelling. And that movie fucks it up. And this movie does that left and right.
I will agree with you on the Richard Parker dad storyline not working because this doesn't belong. There's no point for it. Like you said, there's no point for it. And I agree with that. And the reasons that I have for investing in it is being that, well, Peter wants to know and that's enough for me. Like that's because I'm so lost in the world. I'm so deep into it that I'm not looking at it from an overview. And that's my fault and that's my bad because I need to be able to pull myself out of it and look at it critically. And yeah, you're right. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't belong there. You win all of the
by the way, the only reason that I am kind of pulling myself out of it and asking those questions, and I totally understand where you're coming from in that you are not necessarily, the only reason I do that is because it doesn't work for me. That's the only time I pull back and say, okay, but why isn't this working for me? And that's when I start to examine certain things, because if I'm invested in something emotionally or engaged in it or whatever, I don't need to ask, but you know, a ton of people hate Super 8. I love Super 8. I can pull myself back and say, okay, does the monster really tie into this other story that's being told? Maybe not. But because I'm on board, I fill in those, I connect those dots myself. So if something's working for you, you don't necessarily pull yourself back and say, okay, but why? It's only when something doesn't work that you say, why doesn't this work for me? And I found myself doing that through almost the entire movie, that I was constantly outside myself saying, why doesn't this work?
I think the reason that we're having the conversation we're having is because I have given the movie a ton of credibility with, I still have this comic mentality that, I mean, I still buy, I buy comics. Now I go every week and I buy the comics, and they train you for the, you know, this is the chapter that you will have questions asked, and then in the next chapter you'll have some answers and you'll have more questions asked. And that's very much what they're trying to do here. And from a comic book point of view, I don't even think about it. Like the Richard Parker storyline, I don't know that that's over. And I mean, it can be if they need it to be over. It does seem like he's gotten the answers that he needs. But then at the same time, so we know that he was working with Oscorp on animal genetic whatever that they were going to weaponize. We'll probably see that at some point. And who's to say he's not going to pop back up to fight whatever Oscorp is doing? They can do whatever they want to do with it. They can take it in so many different directions. But I've gotten so used to just not even questioning things because I figured that we'll either get an answer down the road or it's – I don't know. But I've just got a blind eye to some of this stuff. And so I don't know. It's I guess that's another fault in some of the way that I'm seeing these things.
No, I mean, I don't mind at all a movie that you know, raises new questions, answers old ones, and is more a part of a larger story, or, you know, and that's one of the problems I think now with franchise filmmaking is that we don't get standalone movies. We just get episodes. But I want each episode to work on its own, and that, you know, something like Winter Soldier, to me, works on its own while still being kind of an episode in the overall Marvel Universe story or whatever. And I don't have faith, unfortunately, if Kurtzman and Orci stay as the writers of this series, I don't have faith that questions will be answered in a satisfying way or that they are going to come back to things. Because even, you know, when you think about Electro, they could have somehow tied it into the first movie or the research that Kurt Connors was doing. They could have created more of a connected universe in terms of making things pay off. Right now it's just like, yeah, people work at Oscorp and then they become supervillains. Because just making it, you know, basically not a maintenance man, but, you know, Maxwell Dillon just works on the power and then accidentally falls into an electric eel tank and becomes a supervillain is not a good origin, I think, for a villain, but it also doesn't tie into any larger story. And then even Harry Osborn's origin, it ties in a little bit more to the bigger story because he gets the super blood and injects himself, and then it turns him into the Green Goblin. But not all the time. It comes and goes, as we discover in the last scene. Yep. And he's starting a team of people to do what again? Like, once again, we get that stupid, shadowy man in black that everyone complained about in the first movie. That post-credit scene where this mysterious figure shows up and taunts Kurt Connors in jail, and then they bring him back in this movie. I just feel like they, rather than listen to the things that people had a problem with in the first movie, and either they could have fixed them, they could have either ditched them, which I'm not always a big fan of. You know, I want properties to course correct instead of just listen to fans and be like, oh, you guys didn't like that? Okay, let me move the chair over here. You know, make that count for something, make that matter. But instead, no, they just trot him out again at the end so we can get the shots of the octopus tentacles and the vulture wings and plant the seeds for a Sinister Six movie that doesn't need to be made.
You say that, there are probably going to be so many people who are like, Sinister Six, what's that? Listen, no joke. I went to the used bookstore the other day. It was Friday after the movie. I went to the used bookstore to look for Spider-Man books. And the guy that checked me out was like, have you seen the new movie? I was like, yeah. And he was like, what did you think about it? I was like, I thought it was really good. I was dreading going to see it, and I thought that it was a very pleasant surprise. And he was like, yeah, I liked it too, but I thought it had I thought it was boring, and I thought that it needed way, way more Rhino in it. I was like, more Rhino? And he's like, yeah, I mean, that movie, I mean, he's in there, but he was barely in it, and I wanted more Rhino. So, like, Rhino, to me, does not make a Spider-Man movie. That's not a compelling villain. But this guy is dying for Rhino. So, I don't know. I mean, who's the audience for these things? Like, maybe this movie made a lot of money. So people are obviously, oh, I don't even know how to say this finished thought without sounding condescending. People want the big, broad villains. People want, I'm just going to leave it there.
But again,
like, people want the spectacle.
Yeah, but I think there's a way to deliver spectacle while also delivering things like character and story. And that's a hard thing to do. And we talk about it a lot on the site, you know, that summer blockbusters have a problem delivering both. And when you can find one that does, it's like, oh my God, this movie is a miracle. Because so few of them do. And I feel like this movie delivers a lot of busy spectacle, and maybe from one scene to another, you might be interested, but I don't think any of the scenes connect. I don't think they add up to a bigger story. I don't think the movie delivers on things like character and story. I think it just delivers spectacle, and I feel like that's a big reason for the inclusion of Electro, is that it allows for big, fancy CGI heavy blue purple loud dubstep set pieces, you know, where things are destroyed and lightning shoots everywhere and everything's kind of a shade of neon, because again, he's not a compelling villain, he's a non-existent character. But he does provide a lot of spectacle.
I would have disagreed with you before this conversation, but now I'm not sure. I thought he was compelling. I thought that he was so hurt that he was compelling. He was so damaged and fractured as a person before. Now, it was broad, and it was very Batman Forever-y. Yes, I get that. But at the same time, I did feel like I felt emotion for him. It upset me to see him being taken advantage of in the ways that he was, and to just want someone to pay attention to him. Like, that worked for me.
I think
he spoke Pepsi, you know, maybe it's just you either like it or you don't. I don't know.
Well, I know. I think there's a way to do the things that you're describing. I think there's a way to create a character that you feel sympathy and empathy for, but between his like goofy hair and his broad performance when he's still Maxwell Dillon, it's hard for me to feel sad for him. And then, you know, the one scene where he is afraid when he first comes into Times Square and he's got his powers and he's scared and wants help. Like, that scene kind of works, right? That's, to me, that's the moment that is what you're talking about. But the rest, because then 2 minutes later, he's just a cartoon villain with no real plan, except to destroy things, and he speaks in one-liners, and he plays the Itsy Bitsy Spider, and I no longer feel like he's damaged or interesting. He's just this CGI thing that Spider-Man needs to fight and defeat.
That's fair enough.
Do you want to talk about the doctor? The doctor who has him imprisoned?
Yeah, let's do that.
Well, that's like one of the worst things in any movie ever. Am I crazy? Like,
it's pretty big. It's pretty broad.
What is going on in this? See, that's the thing. That's why I can't reconcile this idea. I can't remember the character's name. Dr.
Kafka.
Yeah, of course. How can I forget?
Right.
That's why I can't reconcile this idea that Mark Webb is making a relationship movie, because again, to me, he's not particularly interested in the progression of an actual relationship. He's interested in some like kind of cutesy flirting. And again, the two actors sell that very well. I like them together and I want them to be happy together, you know, but I also would be interested in seeing a relationship beyond just some high school cuteness. But so I can't buy this idea that he's making a relationship movie when he has shit in there like Dr. Kafka.
But he does make a relationship movie because that's, I mean, didn't the whole focus of, well, you're okay. Let me see if I understand correctly. So you feel like the focus being put on the relationship doesn't work and the focus being put on the villains doesn't work.
I would argue that there's no focus actually being put on anything, but if there is an attempt at doing a relationship story, I feel like anytime you cut to shit like Dr. Kafka or Electro or Green Goblin or a lot of these other things, I think they are from such a different movie. I feel like they are so big and over the top and truly of a Joel Schumacher universe. Dr. Kafka, I would accuse of being straight out of a Michael Bay movie. I mean, that shit belongs in a Transformers movie for real. I mean, that character, the way it's written, the way that performance is pitched, that is directly out of a Transformers movie, which, wouldn't you know, are also written by Kurtzman and Orsi. I just feel like anytime you cut to that, it undercuts any investment that you might have in any of the relationship stuff, because the two things cannot coexist in the same movie for me.
Yeah. And then they did for me. But I'm telling you, this movie made me weep multiple times.
When? Okay, when Gwen died, sure. But not, I mean, I didn't at all, because I felt like they even blew that moment. Again, the way it's staged, the way it's shot, that's all fine. I just didn't feel like the movie had built up to that scene in a satisfying way. Like, oh yeah, this, they've earned this. I didn't feel like they earned it, but that's me. So I'm guessing you cried once when Gwen Stacy died, but when else?
Okay. Honestly, Times Square, when Spider-Man saves all the people with the staircase or the stairs, that's like the most Spider-Man moment of, for me, that I've ever seen captured on film. It's akin to the subway scene in, or the L train scene in Spider-Man 2, the Raimi Spider-Man 2, when he saves all those people on the train and then they come out and they're like, hey, Spider-Man. It was so moving to me, and it felt, see, it's because I love Spider-Man so much. It's not that the movie necessarily earned anything from that, but it's just that character felt so pure, and it was so I don't know, it's just so emotional for me, like, because I love Spider-Man, and that was Spider-Man doing what Spider-Man does in a very pure form for me, and it got me going. And then at a few points in the movie that happened, but then the last one that happened is when he's mourning the loss of Gwen and the Rhino is attacking the city, and Lil Jorge puts on a Spider-Man costume and goes out and stands in front of the Rhino, and not yet, but then when they're just staring at each other, and then Peter Parker as Spider-Man swings up behind him, you just see the people looking up, and then he says, hey, Spider-Man, and he calls the little boy Spider-Man. I was done. That's it. I am sentimental and I'm sappy, and you talk about the crane thing in the first movie.
Yeah.
That gets me too. That I'm sappy. I can't help it.
Oh, the crane thing, really?
Yeah.
The thing I liked about the crane thing, and I don't like anything about the crane thing, but as I rewatched the movie, I appreciated the fact, I liked the idea of Spider-Man having to get across town in a very short amount of time, and how difficult and exhausting that prospect was. I thought that was interesting. I don't like the way it was executed. I don't like that the solution is that all these guys organize turning their cranes in a matter of minutes, because wouldn't you know, that's the Spider-Man that saved my kid. So I thought that was terrible, but there's an idea there. And I agree. I find it ridiculous that the kid puts on the Spider-Man suit and comes out in the street and the cops are like stopping the mom, but letting the kid go out into harm's way. So none of that worked for me, and I'll admit that it immediately conjured up the last shot, or what should have been the last shot, of Captain America, the First Avenger, where the kids are running in the street with their handmade Captain America shield, which was such a wonderful sort of evocative image for me, and so immediately this is just inviting comparison. However, when he does show up and say, hey, Spider-Man, I'll take it from here. I agree. That's great. And there are those moments throughout the movie where Spider-Man in the suit is really being the Spider-Man that I read in the comics. And I liked those moments a lot. And it almost is to the detriment of the movie because those things are so good. Those few moments are so good that I sit there thinking, like, A, why couldn't the whole movie have been up to this caliber? Or B, how am I not loving this more when it gets this thing so right? How can I not be so on board for this movie? And it puts all of the flaws into even sharper relief, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. It does make sense. What do you think about the moment in the first movie when he rescues the kid out of the car hanging off the bridge and he tells him to put his mask on?
I don't have a problem with it. I mean,
I like that. That's one of those moments that gets me going. I'm apparently at an age in my life where just like a Hallmark commercial can move me to tears. It's ridiculous.
No, but again, you know, not to bring up Man of Steel again, but one of the things that people complained about a lot with Man of Steel, probably myself included, was that Superman didn't seem particularly concerned with helping people or protecting them. And on more than one occasion, even in these Mark Webb Spider-Man movies that I don't like, they have gone out of their way to show Spider-Man helping people, rescuing them, trying to not just rescue the little kid, but rescue him in a way that makes him not scared, which is great. Little touches like that are great. I think I liked the first Amazing Spider-Man better than this one, which surprises me because, again, I felt like that movie was very flawed and not great. This is just me. But I was willing to give the sequel a chance because, you know, it could go either way. It's like they could either double down on what made the first one bad, or they can sort of learn from some of their mistakes. I know there was a lot of studio interference on that movie, so maybe with a little bit more freedom or a little bit more confidence, they can really make the movie that they want to make. And we've seen that before, you know, a first movie kind of finds its legs and then the second one really kicks ass. A lot of comic book movies, comic book franchises have sort of followed that path, you know. Even the Raimi Spider-Mans, I feel like the first movie has a lot of problems, and then the second one gets a lot of it right. So I was willing to hope that this would be the Spider-Man 2 of the Amazing Spider-Man series, and for me, it's an even bigger mess than the first one.
Well, you know, leading up to this, we talked about it, and I said we could use a little more Raimi in the stuff that's going on now because he had a – I don't know. What would you say? It was just kind of a fun quality that I feel like is missing, and everything feels so so grim now, and his movies don't feel grim, but they feel – I don't know. They feel – it's Raimi. It's just Three Stooges, and I don't – you know what I'm saying?
Believe me, I don't want to go off on a tangent of why I think the Raimi movies are so much better because I know that now there's a weird sort of revisionist people all of a sudden don't like those movies as much. And that's I know that, you know, they weren't always your bag and there's people who just never really got on board with them. And that's fine. To me, those movies have so much heart. That Raimi clearly loves Spider-Man so much and that it comes through even in Spider-Man 3, which is a big mess. I feel like the love of the character still comes through, the desire to be good and decent and heroic above all else still comes through. And the way that can be a challenge when you are trying to live a life and find love and be a good son or nephew, as it were, be a good student, be a good employee. All of those things come through for me. And I don't get the impression that Mark Webb loves Spider-Man at all. I feel like he remains a director for hire. I think he's doing what he can with the material. It's not a hack job in the way that Martin Campbell doing Green Lantern is a hack job. But at the same time, I don't like what he's doing with the series. I don't think he has a handle on storytelling at all. And I don't get any love for the character. I do think that it does a couple of things really right. Andrew Garfield in the suit is great. I love the suit. I love the way Spider-Man looks and moves. All of that stuff is great. And I wish all of that could be transplanted into a movie that has a better story and the heart of the Raimi series.
Maybe one day we'll get that, because I do agree with you. The Spider-Man, and for me, the Spider-Man in this movie in particular, it's the best film representation of Spider-Man that I feel like we've gotten. He's funny. Just like, okay, the Times Square scene when he's like wearing the fire hat and he's like, Mike, Big John, he's like high five. That's so right. Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And then go like tapping on at the beginning of the movie, he's tapping on the window and telling him to roll it down. Like, there's just little touches. I'm like, this is so Spider-Man.
Yes.
And I've never gotten that from any, like, the Raimi movies, as much as I want to like some of, and I do like them. I've been overly harsh on them, I think. And I don't hate them. And I liked them at the time, but I don't feel like I was ever able to invest in the relationships like I can invest in the relationship. I said that, but which is weird because it doesn't seem like something's clicking for me like it's supposed to. I'm like, why am I identifying more with the newer stuff than with the stuff that is reflective of what I grew up with? That it doesn't on paper add up, but here we are. But Spider-Man has never been so like fun. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So, yeah.
It's just fun. Maybe in the future we can get a Spider-Man movie that has all of the things that I like in it and all the things that you like in it. And maybe that would mean no Orson and Kurtzman and a different director. But with things being the way they are with Sony, I guess, I don't know, I'm kind of grateful because the circumstances that this movie was born in, that both of these movies have been born in, which is just to keep a franchise alive, to keep rights in possession of Sony, these could have been much worse than they are. I mean, I like these, but even for you, like, they could have been awful. They could have been Transformers 2 awful. Or do you think that they are Transformers 2 awful?
No, I think that's probably overstating, but I don't think this one is super far off. There are things in this movie that I can point to that I like. There's some sincerity in the performances and moments that I like, whereas in Transformers 2, I mean, that is just an ugly, hateful movie that doesn't have anything to like about it. But in terms of structure and storytelling, I don't think they're far off from one another. I think the tones are different, you know? I don't think this movie is mean-spirited the way that Transformers 2 is. But yeah, I you know, so much of this movie to me is just born out of cynicism, and I didn't want it to be because again, once they got that first one out of the way where they had to reboot the character and hold on to the rights and all that, they could have gone any direction, and it's just about table setting and franchise building and corporate tie-ins, and if you hold up your phone during the credits for the soundtrack that they want to sell, it'll download pictures of the Sinister Six for the movie that they want to make. Did you read about all that?
I didn't know. I would have helped. I gotta go see it again now and hold my phone up.
No, you didn't hear about that?
No, I did not.
I don't remember the name of the app. There's that app that tells you like what song you're listening to.
Shazam?
I think so, yeah. So if you hold it up during the awful Alicia Keys song that plays,
you don't even like the song.
No. Did you? It belongs from a different movie. What movie is that from?
Well, I agree with that.
I didn't care for most of the score. I found it generic at times and inappropriate at others. I will say that the last moments of the movie, the score swells and it's heroic in a weird way, but it was kind of working for me, and coupled with the fact that we're coming right off the scene with him and the kid and he goes to fight Rhino and it cuts to black. I mean, that leaves me feeling better about the movie than I had felt for the entirety of the movie. You know, I felt like it nailed its last 15 seconds. So good job, movie.
But did you want more Rhino? Is this what you're saying?
I'm not interested in more Rhino. I don't even understand their plan. Like, he goes to see Harry and Mysterious Man goes to see Harry in jail. Harry says, I want to keep it small for no reason than just to say the word Sinister Six without saying the word Sinister Six. And And they say, let's start with this guy. But their plan is what? Just put him in a suit and let him loose on the streets? Like, what is their master plan?
I don't know.
Right. It doesn't make any goddamn sense. It's just a way of ending the movie on sort of an action beat. And I feel like, again, the movie could have ended... Well, no, I guess not. It couldn't have ended in a sad place. But Gwen Stacy probably needed to die earlier than she did for that to resonate.
So she's falling. He throws the web out. The little hand comes out of the web to grab
She's hand.
Boom, credits. We all walk out to the jaunty Alicia Keys song. End of the movie.
Holding up our Kazam. No, she probably should have died earlier in the movie just so that we could deal with some of the emotional fallout, you know, before he decides to go back to being Spider-Man, because it doesn't make... And then to have it where, like, oh, now I'm going to listen to her graduation speech, which I haven't listened to yet, on a flash drive where the camera is conveniently placed directly... It's not even, like, someone holding a camcorder in the crowd. It's literally a professional camera aimed directly at her. Her speech ties in directly to the themes of the movie, which are non-existent. It's a repeat of the same bullshit trope from the first movie where he listens to Uncle Ben's message as the movie ends, and it applies to what he has learned. So it just repeats that, and then also her speech is different the second time.
I didn't notice, and I saw it twice.
Yeah, it's different, which, again, is just sloppy filmmaking. But okay, whatever. So you hold up your phone, and it downloads, like, teaser images of the Sinister Six. So I had seen these teaser images, because immediately somebody was like, oh, let me just try it before the movie opens. I'll just listen to the song on iTunes and do it. And it worked. So every site slash film, everybody had the images posted. Okay. And they're actually the exact same images that play over the closing credits. If you didn't know what you were looking at, you wouldn't know what you were looking at. It's like the corner of the Goblin glider. It's a little bit of Doc Ock's arm. It's part of the Vulture wing. It's... maybe like a quiver or something for Kraven. And then a part of a mask that some people say is Mysterio. A lot of people seem to think is Chameleon. And then who's the guy writing it? Is it Drew Goddard?
I don't know.
I can't remember who's writing. I want to say it's Drew Goddard. Whoever's writing it, or Brian Fuller. I can't remember who it is. Then, like, the next day comes out and says, like, yeah, I'm not sure which villains we're going to use yet. So they're teasing villains that, and they don't even know who's in the movie. This is corporate bullshit cynicism.
This is the worst of our culture. When
it
you're
is.
Things that you haven't even planned yet. You're just like, well, these are things. Why don't you just show, like, the cover of a comic book and say it could be any of these people?
Right. But you and the way they go about it is, like, you have to use your, you know, your Sony device and this app, and you have to listen to this song, and then you get teaser images for a movie that we haven't really fully conceived of yet. And hold on, here comes a commercial for X-Men First Class, which has nothing to do with our movie, but fulfills a contractual agreement with Fox. There's no soul in any of this. It's all just, it's filmmaking by corporation.
Well, and I agree with everything that you're saying. It is filmmaking by corporation, and it makes me sick, and I've just checked out so much, which is why it surprises me so much that I cared so much about this movie, and I'm going to keep saying so much, is trending on Twitter. Let me say something about Gwen Stacy real quick before we go.
Yeah.
You can't go see anyone who's read a comic book or who likes Spider-Man. Gwen Stacy is famous for dying. That's
right.
The contribution. She didn't do much in living. We know her because she died. And I was really rooting for this movie to not kill Gwen Stacy and do something interesting with it, because I feel like – go ahead.
I agree 100%.
You have this character and you have an opportunity to do something that you've not had an opportunity to do in 40 some odd years. They killed her in 1973. So she's been off the table in both cinematic and – I mean, Raimi had her like basically a cameo in part 3. But you have an opportunity to do something with this character that's largely untouched for decades. And so I was like, don't do it. You know, you have this – you can do anything. Don't do that. Don't do the obvious. And then at the beginning of the movie, you know, they do the high school speech. And I was like, you know, well, maybe they're just setting – maybe they're playing with my expectations, because I do feel like these movies have played with my expectations and not always done what I thought they were going to do. And it would have made me happier had they not killed Gwen Stacy and had that been a misdirection to, I don't know, send her to England so that he loses her and he has to forge on, and then you can still – I don't know. You can bring her back in another movie, or you can have her be the one that got away. But do something with her that's different instead of going down the same slavish path. Like, we have to follow the comic book, and it has to be the Green Goblin that does it. Even if we have to write the Green Goblin into the very last 10 minutes of the movie when he wasn't in it at all to do it, we have to do this. And so all the way up until the end, I was thinking, you know, well, maybe they're not going to do it. And I thought that they showed it in the commercial, like the TV spots in the trailer when they go through the glass. I was like, did they just show Gwen Stacy dying on a national TV trailer or commercial? And then it didn't pan out like that. And I was like, okay, cool. They're not going to do it. But then they did do it. And I lost respect for them. And I was kind of angry at the movie. But then the same speech that's different, and that's different at the end of the movie than is at the beginning of the movie, tied everything together for me. And as much as it didn't work for you, it did work for me. And I thought, okay, well, Gwen Stacy, this is the impact that she now has on Peter. Her impact through her death is going to haunt him. Hopefully, depending on who writes it, it will haunt him, and it will be a foundation for which he can build his character instead of being the person that he's been in the same two movies. But cynically, you point out that Star Trek II leaves us in the exact same place that Star Trek I begins. And so maybe they will do none of these things. But if they do, I hope they do. I hope that they use what they have bought with her death to do something interesting that hasn't been done before. That makes sense. That was a lot of thoughts.
It makes 100% sense. Here's the issue. Everything you just said about Gwen Stacy, that's true of Uncle Ben. That's what they did in the first movie. He dies. Peter is haunted by it. It motivates him to be the person that he's going to become. He listens to the message and decides to persevere and be Spider-Man. I mean, it repeats beat for beat exactly what they had already done with Uncle Ben. So, again, it's just the movie spinning in circles. And what they're going to end up doing is, in Spider-Man 3... Amazing Spider-Man 3, he'll be mopey for a little while, and then, you know, he'll meet Mary Jane, and then they'll tease that, like, that's going to be a thing. When they first – I'm with you 100%. They should not have killed Gwen Stacy. First and foremost, because their dynamic is the best thing about either of these two movies. And even the people that don't like the movies, you know, even the critics who write about them and don't like them – point to that. Like, no, the two of them have chemistry. They're cute together. So now you've shit-canned your greatest asset out of slavish faithfulness to the comics, even though you've demonstrated a willingness to discard canon and say that Peter is created because his dad injected his bloodline into spiders, and that's how Spider-Man was created. So they redo his origin, but they're not willing to do something different with Gwen Stacy. When they announced, you know, when she was the love interest in the first movie, I just felt like it was this cynical attempt to, you know, well, we're not doing what Raimi did because we have Gwen Stacy and not Mary Jane. Meanwhile, they did Mary Jane. I mean, she's playing the Mary Jane character. She kind of has the personality of Mary Jane. Had they just left her a redhead and called her Mary Jane, it would have been fine. But because they were trying to suggest that they were different, they went with Gwen Stacy. Okay, fine. But own that choice. And like you said, don't just decide to kill her because, well, that's what they did in the comics. Down to, like, she's even wearing the exact costume, right?
Yeah, she is.
It's just, like, I don't like that mentality of, like, well, we have to bow to what the fanboys expect. And if we have Gwen Stacy, we gotta kill her. Because I don't necessarily think it's part of the story that they are telling, or at least it's not a unique part of the story that they are telling, because the exact same emotional beats, the exact same character growth that come from Gwen Stacy's death were already done with Uncle Ben's death.
Yeah, that's true. So I guess cousin Stacy should be watching. What we previously established, all Stacys must die.
I really—that's that should be what the name of the next Amazing Spider-Man 3. All Stacys must die. I found myself kind of laughing when we got to that scene at the end. Like, really, another goddamn Stacy funeral? And I was amazed at just how many beats in this movie are repeated verbatim from the first movie. I just there's no real attempt at growth as far as I can see. They just introduce new characters, but they serve a lot of the same functions. Or are worse, you know. I think Electro is actually a step down from Kurt Connors. I think Harry Osborn presents new problems from a storytelling perspective. He's different in terms of, like, they didn't have anything like that in the first film, but I don't think they've cracked the Harry Osborn problem, especially not when so much of it is contingent on magic blood.
Fair enough.
I guess we'll stop talking about Amazing Spider-Man 3. Or 2, sorry. I'm getting ahead of myself, obviously. I know I've sat here and just complained about the movie for 90 minutes. I'm genuinely glad that you really liked it, not just because I always want people to like movies and it's more fun to like stuff than to not like stuff, but because it made for a way more interesting conversation.
Well, that's awesome. I'm glad to have been a part of it, and I'm glad you asked me to be on here.
It was awesome, and you will hopefully be back on again very soon.
I want to come back for Death to All Stacys.
It's going to happen, everyone. I don't know what our next episode is going to be. I know people had asked that we announce what our upcoming shows are. I don't know, everyone. So just listen to whatever it is. And I'm sorry for not liking Amazing Spider-Man 2 more than I did. I'm anticipating some interesting conversation in our comments section. But thank you so much, Heath, for talking about the movie.
And thank you so much for having me.
We will talk to you guys soon. Heath, do you want to take us out?
Excelsior!